Welcome back to another exciting episode of PAX, the feature editor. I have a fabulous guest. His film, Xenophobes. I have director, writer, and great guy, I'm sure. Hal Dace is here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Your film's going to debut on Amazon this week, I think.
That's right. It's just coming out on Prime Video. Yeah. We're very proud of it.
It turned out really well. Now, how do you, we can start right there, something, how do you get on Prime Video, or is that you just leave that to the other people to do?
Yeah, I left it to the distributor. He was exploring various different avenues, and he has contracts with various different outlets. And on this occasion, they decided Prime was the best outlet for this film.
That's awesome. That gives you a lot of eyeballs, so that's good. That's a positive.
Yeah.
So let's start at the beginning. I noticed that you wrote this with somebody and directed this with somebody. So let's start with the writing. When you're writing with somebody, how do you create the initial project? Do you jump on board with them, or you start it and they join you?
Well, I'd worked with Lance on a previous screenplay. And we had discovered very early on that my strength was high concept and his strength was characters. And I think it's really important in science fiction not to let the characters be two-dimensional. In fact, when I've written science fiction screenplays, the characters have tended to be too accommodating with each other. They're always helping each other, and there's no conflict. And so Lance helps inject some real personality into the characters and comes up with various ideas about how they could come into conflict with one another. And it makes it feel like it's a character-driven drama instead of a high-concept sci-fi drama.
I would argue your film is both of those things. It's very high-concept and it works both. That's what you guys do, very complement each other very well, I would say, because both the things you're looking for are there.
Terrific. Well, I'm glad you think that.
So let's discuss with the high concept. I liked how you took, most science fiction at times rushes things to get there, but you didn't. Your character's been on the ship for a while. They take a while to get to where they need to go. And then they come back to another problem, which I don't want to get into because that's kind of the end. So I was trying to decide, did you have two films in mind here and mash them? Because it kind of feels like there's one journey they're taking, and then you're like, okay, well, then we're going to have a second journey at the end.
The reason why I wanted to do it that way is because I feel like whenever anybody is on a quest of any kind, you feel like once you finally achieved that quest, you'll receive the accolades you deserve, whether that's just a high paying job and you'll appreciate the extra money you're earning, whatever you think is going to be your reward. And I just wanted to tell, the kind of story that a lot of us experience in real life, which is that almost regardless of whether you succeed with your quest, your reward often isn't nearly as satisfying as you think it's going to be. And in fact, it could even be catastrophic. And that's just the life sandwich you get sometimes.
I like it.
There's also a mirror effect going on. In the first half of the film, the astronauts feel like they're the aliens visiting the indigenous population, and they're aware that they're the aliens. But they think that when they get back home, that they'll won't be aliens anymore. They'll be humans, and they'll be with their fellow humans. And unfortunately, they feel a little bit alienated.
They do. Okay, let's discuss something to think. When they meet the aliens, I thought that whole thing was kind of different. I've never seen that in a film before. So is that you just showing me something different, or just something you always wanted to see in a film?
I had the same dilemma, and I don't mean to compare myself to him, but I had the same dilemma that Stanley Kubrick had when he was working on 2001. I've read lots of interviews about him, and he said that the only reason that they didn't show the aliens at the end was because they ran out of money. And I would argue that it's I think it's a little distracting if when you meet an alien that's got 8 eyes and 20 tentacles and is all gooey looking or something, or has big teeth and is killing everyone. It's just a little bit distracting that the story is about the humans and how the aliens don't want to talk to them. And when they finally do get to talk to them, it's not up close and personal the way you would hope it would be. And that way the audience gets stayed focused on the theme of alienation instead of getting distracted by what the aliens look like and whether they're cuddly or scary or gooey.
Oh, I think what you hit that right nail on the head. That's exactly what I was hoping for. Then we got here. I'm like, oh, that's different. I kind of like it. You spend a lot of time giving characterization on the ship. And you work a lot of this with green screen constant. I mean, it's also behind them, in front of them, and they're doing things on it. How was to direct your actors through that? I mean, there's a lot going on all the time.
Well, luckily, they have each other. I remember seeing an interview of Mark Hamill, and I know it was definitely Mark Hamill. I'm not sure if Harrison Ford was in it. It's because I'm quite old. Way back in 1977, when Star Wars first came out, Mark Hamill was complaining about the scene where he's shooting the TIE fighters from the Millennium Falcon. You know, there
Yes.
were two TIE fighters, and the two of them managed to shoot them down, or maybe there's four of them, I can't remember. But anyway, I remember Mark Hamill commenting on how it was kind of hard, the idea of aiming his big giant rifle thing at the ships and shooting at them when there was nothing but blue screen in front of him. And I can understand that, but luckily in our film, when we were utilizing blue screen, and the only reason we didn't use green screen is because their uniforms were green.
Ah.
And that wouldn't have made any sense. So we used blue screen to contrast with the green uniforms. And you know, they had each other to talk to. There was always someone else in the room, or they had their controls in front of them. They weren't sort of shooting at random objects that didn't exist in real life. And so I think it's a little bit easier for them than it might have been. And so we got away with it, I hope.
So let's go a bit on the set design since you just brought it up. So those actual computers are real then. There's things to do on them where they're sitting.
No, well, I mean the objects are real. The display screens were
Well,
blue
yes.
screen. Yeah, so we faked the display screens, but the
Yes.
actual furniture was real furniture. And I have to let you in on a secret here. The problem was that originally I visualized the bridge as being very I don't know what's the right word. Not very advanced looking. L looking a bit like a
Oh,
submarine. It was supposed to
okay.
look a bit like a submarine bridge, instead of the big, huge, fancy, beautiful bridge that we eventually provided them. And that was because it did, the original design did not do well in testing.
Oh.
There were lots of members of the audience that we tested the original design, and they did not like it. So we changed it to the more beautiful, vast, gigantic spaceship design, and everybody loved that one. So it is a little incongruous that the furniture doesn't really match the background, but people don't seem to care. I haven't heard a single complaint about that aspect of the film. So I think it's because the actors are, you're focused on the actors,
You're
and you kind of
correct.
notice the grand design behind them, and you don't seem to, I don't think people care very much that the furniture doesn't really match properly.
I agree with you 100% because I'm focusing on the interrelationships. They're constantly talking to each other and they're having board meetings. I mean, they're constantly dialogue. I don't have time to read. I mean, I notice the screen behind them, I know stuff going on between it, but I would say I don't need to watch that because I'm focused on conversation.
Great. Well, I'm glad that worked.
Well, it worked for me. So, while you're directing with somebody, do you guys split it up or do you shoot scenes together or how does that work?
Well, Penny, who I co-directed the film with, plays a role in the film as well. She's the ship's doctor. So obviously I directed those scenes. And when it comes to the other scenes, there were it just worked according to the logistics of the situation. Sometimes she was there and I wasn't, which was fairly rare. So she would direct the scene. More frequently, I was there and she wasn't. And then probably about a third of the time, we were both there and we were just totally collaborating. And it was just to be as pragmatic as possible. And also, neither one of us likes the idea of one person being completely in charge. We both believe strongly in two heads are better than one. And you know, we love the Coen brothers. We're big fans of the Coen brothers, and we know how they work. And we always try to work like the Coen brothers do. Not that we're as good as them, but you know, they're our
That's
heroes.
okay. They had to start Blood Simple, right? You got to start
Yes,
somewhere.
I saw that when it first came out.
So your CGI, I mean, you, how much time did you have to spend as a director working all that green screen stuff in and playing with images and what you wanted?
You mean in post-production?
Yes.
I it took me about 2.5 years. I did it all myself.
2.5 years?
Yeah, it takes a long
Wow.
time. You have to build models. You have to animate it frequently. Like obviously all the spaceships and missiles had to be animated. I used to work in the animation film business in London way back in the early 90s, so I learned a lot about animation then. I worked with a lot of the ex people who had previously worked on Roger Rabbit. So I was very lucky to work with a lot of talented people. And I was a film editor and they were the animators, but I would ask them lots of questions. How do you do this? How do you do that? And they would explain everything to me. And I never forgot that. But then, of course, I had to learn 3D animation and modeling. And I'd spent about 20 years teaching myself how to do it.
Wow.
Now I would have loved, we just didn't have the budget, but I would have loved to have hired a proper team to do it, but we just didn't have the money. So I just had to do the best I could. And I got lots of advice from friends of mine who were still in the business. And they helped me figure out how to do things whenever I had problems.
Well, that's independent filmmaking, right? You kind of
Yeah,
have to do a
that's
lot
the
on your
idea.
own. It's kind of like being an independent podcaster. I have to watch all the films, organize it's just me. So let's go back to a couple of, I want to go over a few locations.
Okay.
The actual studio for the ship, is that a set or is that a basement? I mean, because you're playing with everything. I don't know where you are.
Well, that town in Onega, Kansas, I was introduced to that location by a friend of mine who had to live there previously. And we were just biking. We were out on our motorcycles and we wanted to go for a nice run. And he said, I used to live in this nice town. And it's about 55 or 60 miles northeast of Manhattan, Kansas, which is where I live. Where I am now. And I loved it when we drove through. I just thought it was a great location. And so when I was planning the project and writing the script, I knew I wanted to shoot all the live action stuff in the second half of the film there anyway. And so I went to the town commission to ask permission to film. And they said yes, of course. And then I asked them, I've been having trouble finding a studio. I had been looking for a studio for 6 months. And they said, "Oh, we've got the perfect place. It's our county fair building.
Ah.
The Pottawatomie County Fair building. It's a very large building, completely empty, and it's got a kitchen and bathrooms. It's the perfect film
Oh,
studio."
that's excellent.
Yeah, and they rented it to me at a very good rate that I could afford. We rented it for a whole year. We had to move everything out for 2 weeks so they could hold their county fair, and then we moved everything back in again. It was pretty wild. And keeping in mind, this was in the middle of COVID, believe it or
Oh.
not. We shot this film in 2020 in the middle of the COVID pandemic. We had over 100 people involved in this production, and not a single person got sick. And I think that's a testament to the fact that we were all quite careful. We all believed in the project very much. We were all very motivated to do the best we could to make this film, and none of us wanted to get sick. So we all wore masks all the time, except of course when the actors had to take their masks off and perform. And we all kept our distance from each other whenever we were able. And just, you know, we just I just think, you know, sometimes the human body decides that it just can't get sick right now. Get sick
Sure.
after we're done, but not now. And psychologically, I think you can beat the virus when things like that happen.
So the swimming pool and all the outdoor shots are this town.
No, the swimming pool was filmed in Salina, Kansas, at the YMCA.
Okay.
But all of the outdoor shots of Onega were filmed in Onega.
Yeah, I want to go back to you renting out this studio space. So you had said you had a kitchen and thing, and you had the act. It took you how long did you spend shooting this? That'll help me with my next question.
It took about 4.5 to 5 weeks, something like that. And it was very strange
Okay.
because we ended up shooting the entire film in reverse. We shot the final scene that's in front of the factory and inside the food
Yes.
factory first.
Oh.
The scenes in the on board the ships, because there's actually two ships, there's the Wichita as well as the Jerusalem. We shot the scenes of her getting up in her study last. The last scene we shot, and it was intended that way, but because of the availability of the actors and the crew over time, it became increasingly clear that we were going to end up shooting the films backwards. It's completely baffling. I haven't, but the actors didn't seem to mind. They always understood where they were in the story, and they were always able to conjure up the appropriate emotions that went with that moment. It was amazing.
I was working with children.
Oh, that was another thing. That's another reason why I love working with Penny Colors. She's probably the most accomplished theater director in Kansas. And she was, up until recently, the artistic director of the Manhattan Art Center, which is our local amateur theater. But it's a very highly organized, very well-funded amateur theater. And she was creative director there for about 20 years. And she directed lots and lots of plays. Her productions were outstanding, always excellent acting. And one of the things that she did 2 or 3 times a year was to direct children in children's plays. So she knew who all the best child actors in town were. And when I showed her the script, she knew exactly who should play those kids. And they were amazing.
So I would say you're very heavily female based in this film. Your captain's female, a lot of people are female. Was that something you planned in your writing process, or that was just a casting decision?
Well, I wrote the original treatment in 2017, and I knew when I wrote that I wanted the captain to be an Indian woman, a South Asian Indian woman. And the main reason why is because I think I was inspired by, the concept of Gandhi. I was inspired by the idea that she was chosen by the President of the United States to run this mission because she was famous for being having the ability to resolve conflicts and she became famous on Earth for being able to do that, and that ability just reminded me of Mahatma Gandhi, and so I just felt it would be correct to honor his background by making the character Indian. But also, I also felt that there hadn't been enough good quality female captains of spaceships. Captain Janeway wasn't bad, but I wasn't in love with her. And I wrote it before Star Trek Discovery was planned. And of course, although the main character of that TV show wasn't a captain, I still feel like they kind of stole my thunder a little bit by making the main character a female with brown skin. But it's okay, it didn't matter to me. I still went ahead and wanted to keep it that way. So I knew that I had a good mixture of male female. Originally, the first officer was supposed to be a Chinese man. And we had cast that role, but then when the pandemic hit, he was too scared to do the job, and so he dropped out. And then Penny Colors said, "There's a fantastic woman in a play I just directed, and you should choose her." And I said, "Well, won't that make the film a little bit too female balanced?" And she didn't care. She wanted it to be more female balanced. And so I decided, to audition her. And she was such a good actor, Jessica, that I decided, who cares about the gender? And it'll be an interesting dynamic between two female leaders on the bridge anyway. So let's go forward and just do it. And I think it worked fine.
Okay, I want to go back to the aliens. When we meet the aliens, I can say that. I don't think I'm ruining anything because that's the whole part of the plot. Did you try different voices for the aliens? Because they do kind of change your voice a little bit.
Penny and I talked about this. We both are actors. I won the Best Actor Award when I was in high school. And it was a big high school with a lot of competition. And then I moved to London when I was 18, and I was cast in three plays in London. But then I decided to ch switch to the film industry, and I became a film editor. So, but I love acting, and I miss acting. I appeared in one of Penny's films. I say her film, but we both directed it, but she wrote it. And I enjoyed the role that I had in her film so much that I really wanted to do some more acting. And she, of course, wanted to play the doctor, but we both toyed with the idea of playing other roles as well. We didn't want to quite go the whole Peter Sellers and Dr. Strangelove route, but just those few little supporting roles. So she got to play the President of the United States voice and the robot voice before the alien sort of takes over the
Right.
robot's voice. And we agreed that there's nothing wrong with that. That nobody will mind. Let's just let ourselves have some extra roles. And so the two roles I gave myself was the Russian oligarch at the beginning.
Yes.
And so I worked on my Russian accent for that. And then I decided I wanted to be the alien.
Ah, okay.
So actually, that's my voice. I didn't audition anyone to do it. I just did it my voice myself, but I also, you probably noticed, processed it quite heavily.
Yes,
So
I
now some people
do.
have told me they recognized my intonations and knew it was me,
Oh,
but
I
I
don't
tried
know
to
you that
disguise it as much
well.
as I could.
Well, I don't know you, so it's going to be hard for me to go, yeah, that's the director, but that's just people that know you. Music for your film, how did you decide on your music?
Well, I've known Scott Freebie since first grade. He's a very close friend of
Oh.
mine, we were neighbors. And he, while I was living in England for 20 years, he was becoming a very popular band teacher in the local middle school. And when I came back here, I used to see him on our local cable channel, having fun with his students. People would just videotape him because he was such a beloved teacher and so amusing, and he so motivating for his students, and his students would deliver wonderful performances. And I just thought, wow, this guy is amazing. I remember loving him when I was a kid, but I didn't know he was going to turn into this guy. And then I invited him over for supper, and we had a long talk, and his wife kept complaining that he kept composing music for TV commercials for his church, even though his church didn't make TV commercials. His wife kept saying, "Scott, why are you composing music when nobody's commissioned you to compose this music?" And he just couldn't stop himself. And so he sent it some of it to me. I thought, wow, this guy's a really
Love
good composer too. And so I asked him a couple of times to compose music for our films, but he felt like our two previous films were a little bit too controversial for his taste. I
Fair
mean,
enough.
he's a an elder in the Mormon Church, and I was worried there might be controversial things in this film that might make it difficult for him to do it. But I also remember from junior high school, what we called middle school in those days, that he was a huge Star Wars fan. And I thought, I bet he'd love to compose some Star Wars style music. So as soon as I finished the first draft of the screenplay, I sent it to him and said, "I'd really love it if you would compose the music for this." I warned him about some dodgy scenes later in the film that he might feel are would compromise his views. And he said, "Nope, no problem. This stuff is okay. I understand how teenagers behave, and I would love to do the music for this." And so I was so excited. And you know what? He composed the whole thing before I even filmed it. That's how
Wow.
excited he was about composing the music for it. He had to make adjustments, obviously, here or there, but a lot of it was already composed, the vast majority of it, just from the script. And he loved the film so much that when he was working on the orchestration and everything, he must have watched the film hundreds of times. He said this to me to my face, and he said it to our actors as well. I've witnessed him saying it to the actors, that he enjoyed the film so much, it never bothered him for 1 minute that he had to watch the film over and over again while he was composing the music.
Oh wow, he's a better man than I. Nothing against anybody's film. I have problems watching myself over and over again, let alone a film.
Yes.
Okay, I just want to go back to the actors again. So you found the small town, we discussed that. Now you had to bring all your actors in. They were okay with all coming to the small town during COVID? Like
Not
that's
all
not
of them. Some of them
okay.
were local actors, but you're right,
Okay.
that several were out of towners. Because there just didn't seem to be people who were right for it. I actually did cast the role of the captain. There is a mixed race lady who lives here in town. In fact, I saw her just a few days ago, who accepted the role and wanted to play it. But she was going to have to possibly quit her job. And then when I told her we're going to be filming it in a town 60 miles away, we're going to have to be driving there every day, she said, "No way, no way, I can't do it. I can't face that." So she dropped out. So she left me kind of in a lurch. But because of the pandemic, the schedule got delayed and delayed and delayed. So it didn't turn out to be that big a problem. I went on to IMDb Pro, and IMDb Pro has very good casting tools. And I found several people, and I asked them to audition. And Svetlana Tulasi's audition was, as I mentioned earlier, the character of Captain Janeway from Star Trek Voyager. She did a speech that Voyager that Captain Janeway gives in one of the episodes about her past, about an incident that was really harrowing. And Svetlana did this speech. It's like a 4 minute speech, and it almost moved me to tears. I could not believe how outstanding her performance was. It far outshone any of the other auditions I got. But the trouble was, she was living in Moscow, Russia, where she had grown
Oh.
up. That's why at one point in the film she mentions she's from Goa, because there
Yes.
is a well-known Russian enclave in Goa, India. So it made sense that she would have a partial Russian accent, even though she's half Indian, half Russian. And so I had to approach the Screen Actors Guild and explain to them that we really, really needed a South Asian actor or an actor of South Asian descent to play this role. And I couldn't find anyone in North America who was good enough to play this role. And they informed U.S. immigration their stand in this situation, their standard reply, which is, "We have no objection." And if SAG says we have no objection, that means you get to import your actor, and
Oh.
they will let you do it. And so she got her green card thanks to her audition and my hard work, and her agent had to work hard as well. And she still lives in Los Angeles to this day. She opened a dance studio. She was already a famous dancer. Hopefully she'll get more roles eventually. But anyway, it was really hard work, and she only just barely got here in time, because it took like 6 months to get her into the country. But I also got an actor from South Carolina, another actor from Texas, and another actor who was of Israeli descent, Mor Ben Haim. At that time, she was living in Hawaii. So I got a total of four actors from out of town. The rest of them are counties.
Okay, fun questions. Your favorite film?
My all-time favorite film is Chinatown.
Nice choice.
And I can't say that there's any connection between the xenophobes and
No,
Chinatown.
definitely not.
But I mean, at least, except that I'm very proud of the acting in our film, and I'm not sure if our acting is quite up to the standards of Chinatown, but I think we got close.
That's good to hear. Your favorite science fiction film?
The 2001 Space Odyssey, definitely.
I figured that was going to be your answer. Last question. What's your favorite movie snack at the theater?
That is a really, really interesting question. I can't believe you asked that. That's a very important thing to me, believe it or
Me
not.
too. Me too.
I have a Vimeo account, as most professional filmmakers have, because when you produce a feature film, you have to upload it to a video
Yes.
sharing site, and Vimeo is the most professional of those. And it allows you to show your films to potential festivals. It allows you to let film critics review the film, but it has to be password protected,
Yes.
so that people, a future member of the audience will pay a subscription to Prime Video to watch it, then they won't get to watch it for free on Vimeo. So I had to choose a password for my film. And the password, I probably shouldn't tell you this,
Don't,
but
I
it's
know what
not
it is,
listed.
so
It's
don't
not
tell him.
listed. It's not listed. So you have to have the link and the password.
Oh, okay.
So
Well, I do have the, I know
if I
what it
tell you the
is.
password, I think it's okay. The password, one word, lowercase, popcorn or nachos.
That's right.
I want to put a question mark after it, but I didn't bother.
Oh.
And so that is the question I ask myself every time I go to the movie theater. And to answer your question, I think I select popcorn more frequently than nachos, but nachos comes in a close second.
Okay, before we let you go, last thing, where can they find your films? Besides Amazon Prime for Xenophobes, we know where that one is. You said you had two others. I don't know where they are.
Well, I've directed 8 feature films in total,
Oh my
and you can
God.
find
Wow.
all of them. They're in 3 different places: YouTube, Prime, and Vimeo. Some of my films you can watch on Vimeo, either by rental or for free. But there's an easy way to find them, and that is just to go to my film production company website, which unfortunately is a little hard to remember, but I will say it anyway. It's called epistrophepictures.com. And Epistrophe is a tune by a famous jazz musician named Thelonious Monk. And I wanted to name my company after my favorite jazz musician's song, one of his songs. So Epistrophe is spelt Epistrophe. So EPIS trophy, TROPHY. So Epistrophe and then pictures. And it's all one word, .com.
Thank you for your time and have a great evening.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.